Today is Wednesday, January 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. Senate was back in session Tuesday, holding hearings on President-elect Joe Biden's cabinet nominees.
Installing really some of the key posts of the upcoming Biden administration.
As the Capitol prepares for inauguration.
The emptiness of the streets in Washington is almost audible. The silence is so profound that you can hear it.
We'll have these stories and more next. The United States Senate was back in session Tuesday for the first time since the deadly riots at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell led off the day.
The last time the Senate convened, we had just reclaimed the Capitol from violent criminals who tried to stop Congress from doing our duty. The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. But we pressed on. We stood together and said an angry mob would not get veto power over the rule of law in our nation, not even for one night. We certified the people's choice for their 46th president. Tomorrow, President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris will be sworn in. We'll have a safe and successful inaugural right here on the west front of the Capitol, the space that President Bush 41 called democracy's front porch. And then we'll move forward.
Current Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also placed responsibility for the riot on President Trump.
President Trump is a threat to our constitutional order, whether he is in or out of office. Even now, he has not accepted responsibility for what he has done and still falsely maintains that the election was stolen. Once he leaves office, do we really expect him to change his tune and accept the truth? Of course not. He will continue spreading lies about the election and stoking the grievances of his most radical supporters, using the prospect of a future presidential run to poison the public arena at a time when we must get so much done. After what he has done, the consequences of which we were all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again. All of us want to put this awful chapter in our nation's history behind us, but healing and unity will only come if there is truth and accountability, not sweeping such a severe charge, such awful actions under the rug. So let me be clear. There will be an impeachment trial in the United States Senate. There will be a vote on convicting the president for high crimes and misdemeanors. And if the president is convicted, there will be a vote on barring him from running again.
Katherine Gibson covers the U.S. Congress for Voice of America, and she's been monitoring today's events. I caught up with her Tuesday afternoon.
Right. So McConnell came to the Senate floor, and he was laying out what's going to be happening in the next few weeks with a number of issues, namely impeachment, which, of course, that article of impeachment that was passed by the U.S. House last week has not yet been transmitted by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi over to the U.S. Senate. She's expected to do that probably by the end of this week so that she doesn't overshadow President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Now, we got a very interesting take on the transmission of those impeachment articles from Mitch McConnell, who really went in detail into what he felt happened at the Capitol on January 6th. He, of course, remembered the Capitol police officers who have lost their lives in relation to this tragedy. And then he talked about culpability. He said that riot was provoked by the president and other powerful people. And by saying other powerful people, he presumably meant U.S. senators, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, who objected to the Electoral College results, who encouraged some of the protesters. And of course, you know, hearing that from Mitch McConnell saying that the president in part provoked that riot, was quite significant and could signal that Mitch McConnell himself could vote to convict Trump when that Senate impeachment trial vote comes up.
And that is something that people around the world are keeping an eye on. When will that singular article of impeachment be transmitted from the House to the Senate so the trial can begin? But today in the Senate chambers, there was regular business to be held. You know, the confirmation of several of President-elect Biden's cabinet members. What can you tell us about those hearings?
That's right. Well, we had a number of confirmation hearings in the U.S. Senate today, installing really some of the key posts of the upcoming Biden administration, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Homeland Security, you know, all of these top posts that are really key in getting out the agenda of the Biden administration. You know, presumably the future Secretary of State, Blinken, saying that he wanted a U.S. foreign policy of humility, which stands in stark contrast to the current Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who has always pushed and said that U.S. foreign policy abroad needs to have more swagger. So what you're talking about here is that really you're seeing a significant shift in the direction of the U.S. government with the approach from some of these Biden nominees. And, if you know, you're going to have a battle ahead, though, because some Republican senators are already saying that they're going to reject some of Biden's nominees. They'll be able to block them in the Senate. Usually a presidential administration that's incoming has their nominees already confirmed and already ready to go. That was not the case with the Republican majority Senate with Biden's nominees.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Roughly 2 weeks after the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen announced that there had been some 100 arrests related to the events on January 6th.
Over the past 2 weeks, we have seen friends, family members, coworkers, and others reporting information to us about those who were involved in the breach of the Capitol on January 6th. The FBI has received nearly 200,000 digital tips from the public. The American people have demonstrated that they will not allow mob violence to go unanswered. Violence and senseless criminal conduct are not the right way to resolve our differences or promote change in our country.
On the eve of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, VOA's Steve Reddish gave me this update on the security measures being put in place.
While the Secret Service, the U.S. Secret Service, which protects the president and the vice president and their families, they are now in charge of the whole event, which is normal under usual circumstances. They're in charge. What has happened is the National Mall, the place where Americans come to watch the inauguration, to witness it, to celebrate, sometimes to protest as well, the National Mall will be closed. And Joe Biden, when he takes the oath of office on the Capitol steps, will be looking out into an expanse that is usually filled with thousands, hundreds of thousands, and sometimes millions of people. And there will be virtually nobody out in front to watch. The mall is closed. It is surrounded by very tall steel, black steel, wrought iron type of fencing that is difficult to penetrate and difficult to navigate around. So the idea is to keep people out of the city and to secure the perimeter. Meantime, there are identification checks underway going through the backgrounds of all of the National Guard troops who were sent to Washington, D.C.
Right. I want to play a little tape from that because General Dan Hokanson, who is with the National Guard, was speaking about that on Tuesday at a Department of Defense press event.
And so we work very closely with law enforcement, and if there's any identification or anything whatsoever that needs to be looked into, out of an abundance of caution, we automatically pull those personnel off the line and make sure that they're not part of the mission set. And in certain cases, we make sure that we get them sent home. But we're in very close coordination also within our organization. We're kind of a family in the National Guard. We grow up together, we work together, and we keep an eye on each other. And if there's any indications, we immediately address it through the chain of command or law enforcement, the appropriate level of agency. But I'm not concerned as a large part of our organization. If you look at 25,000, we've had 12 identified, and some of those they're just looking into. It may be unrelated to this, but we want to make sure, out of an abundance of caution, as I stated earlier, that we do the right thing until that gets cleared up.
Now, on the security note, Steve, you have been in D.C. for a very long time and have covered the inauguration many, many times. How do things compare?
I've been to inauguration since 1973. What I saw downtown is the most security I have ever witnessed in my 45 years of living in Washington. And the security for the Trump inauguration and the Obama inauguration were extraordinary from even inaugurations past. The emptiness of the streets in Washington is almost audible. The silence is so profound that you can hear it, and it rings out that the city is on lockdown and everybody is on high alert for anything that may look suspicious.
I want to follow up on that because, you know, prior to inauguration, the Park Service closed down the Washington Monument, which sits in the middle of the National Mall. And as you mentioned, there's these large fences surrounding the inauguration area around the National Mall. Do we know how long, you know, the security apparatus is going to be left in place after the events on January 20th?
Under normal circumstances, most of the fencing disappears by the next afternoon, by January 21st, under normal circumstances, under normal inaugurations. From what I am told, the fencing and the National Mall will be closed at least through to the weekend, at least through Friday. And depending on the way the security chatter is, they will make decisions on Friday whether to open it back up for the weekend.
Steve Reddish is an executive producer in the VOA News Center. Americans are getting ready to inaugurate President-elect Joe Biden on Wednesday after one of the nation's most contentious elections and a violent assault on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of outgoing President Trump. Michael Sullivan reports on the mood of the nation as the U.S. transitions into its next political phase.
After an unprecedented break-in of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters and funeral of a Capitol police officer, one of five people who died in the riot. Now, unprecedented security for the Biden inauguration January 20th and a second congressional effort to impeach the outgoing president, Donald Trump. Amid ongoing threats of violence, one Seattle man is worried.
There are a lot of people that are Donald Trump supporters that are madder than a nest of hornets. You know, they're dangerous. I don't think they're going away.
He says they're undermining President-elect Joe Biden's efforts to tackle the nation's problems.
Constantly trying to say he's an illegitimate president. And I mean, that's just the start of his term.
A Cuban immigrant in Miami is worried about Biden's progressive politics.
I expect economic, political, and social disasters for a simple reason. He is a socialist.
But another Miami resident says whoever is president deserves to be respected. He hopes Biden is successful.
I hope he does great. He's our president now, so, you know, just as I respect the President Trump, I hope Joe Biden does the best for America. We gotta win.
This woman is also hopeful.
I am very happy because I think there are going to be big changes.
In Santa Monica, California, one man called on Biden to address the nation's pressing problems.
Number one is the virus. You know, we have to do a much better job. You know, we can't keep talking about it. We have to do something about it. They'll do something about it.
And Biden needs to overcome political divisions, say two other men.
I'm hoping that Biden could bring the nation back together. Like, I'm hoping that he could. There's so much I guess you could call it political segregation. Yeah. I don't know why.
That's actually
but it's very intense.
Amid ongoing threats of violence in Washington, D.C. and around the country, the national mood is somber.
It's a mess. I don't know how they're going to fix it. I hope they can.
Nerves on edge ahead of what is usually a jubilant celebration. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
On the last full day of his term in office, U.S. President Donald Trump released a video statement on the eve of his departure from Washington.
My fellow Americans, 4 years ago, we launched a great national effort to rebuild our country, to renew its spirit, and to restore the allegiance of this government to its citizens. In short, we embarked on a mission to make America great again for all Americans. As I conclude my term as the 45th President of the United States, I stand before you truly proud of what we have achieved together. We did what we came here to do, and so much more. This week, we inaugurate a new administration and pray for its success in keeping America safe and prosperous. We extend our best wishes, and we also want them to have luck.
The president called the attack on the U.S. Capitol an attack on everything we cherish and something that can never be tolerated. He also said that the movement that he and his supporters started was just the beginning, that the belief a nation must serve its citizens will not dwindle, but instead only grow stronger by the day.
I go from this majestic place with a loyal and joyful heart, an optimistic spirit, and a supreme confidence that for our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
President Trump will be departing Washington Wednesday morning local time and fly to Florida, opting to skip Biden's inauguration, only the fourth president to do so in the nation's history and the first since 1869. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Eritrean refugees trapped by fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region are in desperate need of food and other essential supplies and services. Lisa Schlein has that story.
The Ethiopian government has denied humanitarian agencies access to Eritrean refugee camps since it began its military offensive in early November. After repeated requests, the UN Refugee Agency reports the authorities finally granted the agency a one-time access to two refugee camps, Mai Eni and Adi Harush in northern Tigray. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says aid workers have found conditions in the camps dire and the Eritreans in desperate need of humanitarian aid.
Refugees were cut off from any supplies and services for more than 2 months. Wells were not functional without fuel for the pumps, leaving refugees to use water from a nearby creek for washing, cooking, and drinking, resulting in diarrhea-like illnesses.
Baluch says a one-time food distribution by the World Food Program 1 month ago is the only assistance the refugees have received for more than 2 months. He says plans for a second distribution are underway. In the meantime, UN staff who accessed the camps have distributed food to 25,000 refugees. Baluch says the number of beneficiaries is of concern because there were 50,000 Eritreans in the two camps before the conflict erupted. So it is likely many fled in fear of their safety.
Refugees told our staff that while they were not impacted directly from the fighting, they were threatened and harassed by various armed groups. The refugees told us they continue to have safety concerns, reporting armed gangs roam the camps at night, stealing and looting.
Before the conflict began, Tigray sheltered 96,000 Eritrean refugees in four camps. Baluch says the authorities continued to deny aid agencies access to the Shemelba and Hitsats refugee camps further north in Tigray. He says the UNHCR continues to receive reports of significant damage to those camps and of refugees fleeing in search of safety and food. Of even greater concern, he says, are worrying reports of refugees being abducted and forcibly returned to Eritrea, where their lives could be at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russia dismissed calls on Tuesday for opposition leader Alexei Navalny's release and threats of sanctions after his arrest, calling the issue a national matter. Responding to calls for sanctions against Moscow a day after Navalny was arrested, a Kremlin spokesman said Navalny's case would be dealt with internally. The United States on Tuesday formally labeled the Chinese government's policies targeting ethnic Uyghur Muslims and other minorities in the northwest region of Xinjiang as genocide. Reports from non-government organizations, journalists, and formal detainees have documented a wide-ranging campaign of repression against Uyghurs. The United Nations estimates that at least 1 million Muslim Uyghurs are held in internment camps. Chinese officials describe them as vocational education centers for job training, rejecting any claim that authorities are engaged in human rights abuses. Officials in Japan's northern Miyagi Prefecture say that a snowstorm that blanketed the region Tuesday caused a multi-car pileup that left one driver dead, at least 10 injured, and stranded about 200 people and at least 130 vehicles. Japanese television showed video from the scene with many emergency crews attempting to help motorists while snow continued to fall. According to the United Nations Women's Campaign Against Gender-Based Violence, 13-45% of women in sub-Saharan Africa experience some form of sexual violence during their lifetime. But TechHer, a Nigerian social enterprise, aims to change that narrative through technology and innovation by applying tech solutions towards societal problems, primarily as they affect women. Africa 54 technology correspondent Paul Ndiho spoke with the executive director of TechHer NG in Abuja, Nigeria.
Chioma Aguebu, welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul, for having me.
You run this incredible organization where you try to teach women, younger women, how to get into the tech space. Help me understand what is it exactly that you do.
TechHer is a social enterprise that focuses on strengthening the voices of women using technology. And we have a simple theory of change that says if women learn or see ways in which technology, when applied to their lives, can enable them, right? So helps them be more effective, they'll pass it on to their children as seamlessly or as smoothly as they pass on religion or culture. And so for us, the whole idea is how do we show women these little bits of technology? And across our, you know, the three different strands of our work, so whether it's digital literacy or tech for governance or community, every single day we try to reach yet another woman who is not directly affected by the, you know, STEM advocacy that typically goes towards children. So there's a lot of advocacy for young girls to get involved in science, technology, engineering, and math, but there's not that much for women who are out of school. So let's say people above the age of 18. So TechHer, we primarily focus on people above the age of 18, of course, women.
So how do you find these women?
When we do digital literacy programs, for instance, depending on the partner we're working with, we might put out a call and ask people if they're interested in certain skills or in certain things that we want to teach them. For Tech for Governance, it focuses on applying technology to societal problems. So I'll give you a quick example. Look at the state of emergency GBV movement, which, you know, TechHer convened in June of 2020 to respond to the rising cases of sexual and gender-based violence in Nigeria. What we did was bring these, you know, incredibly talented and excellent young people together. We started a small coalition, and using that network in Abuja, we were able to not only advocate across 7 states in Nigeria, so holding physical, marches to the state commissioners of police office, but also we engage the legislature, we engage the Nigerian governor's forums, etc. We wouldn't have been able to do all of this coordination if we weren't applying some sort of technology.
You brought up a very good point, and maybe let's go back to the sexual violence thing that you alluded to. Sexual violence is a huge problem across Africa. Where you are in Nigeria, a lot of women who go through that are even scared to come and speak out publicly about what happened to them. So at what extent is those skills you're giving them in terms of how to use technology maybe empowering those women?
We wanted to be practical, right? And so we hosted a self-defense class, you know, and just brought a bunch of women together. We worked with some martial artists, but also some, you know, self-defense trainers, and they taught women how to defend themselves. Again, working with a bunch of people, we formed a little group much earlier last year. And what we started doing was collating incidents of sexual violence reported online. So when we then started, you know, state of emergency GBV in June, we were able to say, these are the ways in which sexual violence present. And these are the reasons why you must believe women when they speak up.
How extensive is your program? Do you reach out to rural women, or you right now focused on maybe the elite women in Abuja, women who live within maybe the suburbs of Abuja?
It's a mixture of both. I think that, but one thing I'm very excited about is we've been very intentional with reaching out to children, which teaches technology to children. And instead, we came up with a simple idea to create a pack of cards that mirror cards that, you know, a card game that we all played as children. And on those cards, we then placed technology information. So there are five categories of cards that you see. And there's one that's, you know, careers in tech. There's another one that's online safety tools. There's another one that's, you know, tech terminologies. And then there's one about Nigeria fun facts and then Nigerian heroines, because we also wanted to give them a bit of culture. And so what would happen is we'd go into the schools, do a bit of an introduction, and then we'll set the kids into groups and have them play. And as they play, they start to ask questions. And that was just level one of the engagement. So it's not just, you know, city women. We have done, you know, events with people in the cities, but we're also very intentional when it comes to reaching out to people who hitherto would not have had any access to technology or technology information.
Chioma, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is holding accountable the Venezuelan judge and prosecutor who took part in the November 2020 trial and sentencing of six executives from the Houston-based oil company Citgo. Known as the Citgo Six, Tomu Vadel, Gustavo Cardenas, Jorge Toledo, Alirio Jose Zambrano, Jose Luis Zambrano, and Jose Angel Pereira were sentenced from 8 to 13 years in prison. In 2017, the Citgo Six were tricked into attending a last-minute business meeting in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. Shortly after their arrival, mass security agents raided the boardroom, detained the men, and threw them into the notorious El Ecoide prison. These Americans, says Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement, have been unjustly imprisoned in Venezuela since November 2017 after being lured to Caracas under false pretenses. In August, trials finally began for the six men after being detained for almost 1,000 days. Two officials of the illegitimate Maduro regime, Judge Lorena Carolina Cornelius Ruiz and Prosecutor Ramon Antonio Torres Espinoza, played critical roles in the kangaroo court trials of each of the Citgo executives. These proceedings were marred by a lack of fair trial guarantees and based on politically motivated charges. The trial was not public as guaranteed by the Venezuelan Constitution, and media and human rights groups were denied access. The wrongful detention and sentencing of these six U.S. persons further demonstrate how corruption and abuse of power are deeply embedded in Venezuela's institutions, said Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. The United States remains committed to protecting its citizens and targeting those who contribute to the illegitimate Maduro regime's usurpation of power in Venezuela. These six men and their families have suffered long enough, declared Secretary Pompeo. It is time for Maduro to release the Citgo Six and let them be reunited with their families.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.